You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms
and conditions. 18 plus. Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real? Or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I feel like, who art Ed?
We're trying to spice it.
Who art Ed?
Mr. Wood, art Ed me.
Yeah. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's off to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and today I am very excited and going to try not to geek out too much because my guest is an art teacher I have been listening to and learning from for more years than I would like to admit that I've been around. My guest today is Timothy Bogatz from the Art of Ed University, Art Ed Radio. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me.
Well, thank you for the invite, Kyle. I've been listening to your show for a while now, too. I love it, and I'm super excited to finally be able to join you. So, like I said, I appreciate the invite.
Oh, thank you very much. And today, I appreciate your flexibility. We're going to be talking about Christo and Jean-Claude, who I have been wanting to talk with someone about for so long, just because their story and their artwork is so interesting to me on a number of dimensions. So, Christo and Jean-Claude, first off, right off the bat, born on the same day, June 13th, 1935. Jean-Claude seems to have been a little bit of a military brat. She moved around going to school in Morocco, France, Switzerland, Tunisia. I mean, quite the life right from the get-go. And apparently she wanted to continue seeing the world. She got her bachelor's. She studied like Latin and philosophy. And then she went on to train to be a flight attendant with Air France. While all of that's happening, Christo's mother recognized that he was a talent from a young age. And she started him in art lessons at like age six. He continued studying art. He went to the National Academy of Art in Sofia. He studied painting, drawing, architecture, kind of the traditional fine arts. And I guess his mother had actually worked at that school as a secretary. So, like, he had an in almost from birth. His father had worked in textiles. So, really, in both avenues, he was kind of going into the family business.
Right. And I've always been like fascinated by his upbringing because, you know, it just sort of marries those two things that, you know, he went on to do between art and just fabric. You know, I love thinking about, you know, this has been his whole life. And you always have to wonder, like, whether that development as a young kid, like how much that influenced his later work. That's always fascinating for me to think about.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I always start with the context, because it's like that biographical information. I love seeing how these threads and these seeds that are planted early on in someone's life just bears out later on in their work. And so Christo, really interesting life, as I said, an exciting character. Like, this is the kind of thing from a movie. 1957, he bribes a railroad employee who sealed him up in a freight car, and he goes to make his way to Vienna. And while he's in Vienna, he goes to the art school, Vienna's Academy of Fine Art. He supports himself doing odd jobs, washing dishes. And I guess he felt like painting classical portraits was kind of on that same level of something he will do to pay the bills, but he wasn't too thrilled about it because he did not sign his name, Christo, on them. He would sign like his family name. I guess he was embarrassed to be doing stuff that wasn't so creative, just the technical arts, but had no problem sullying his family name and putting that on there. The gig economy was alive and well in the mid-20th century. But that actually led to something that was pivotal in his life, aside from where he was, getting into Vienna and eventually making his way to France. While he was doing those gigs painting portraits, that's how he met Jean-Claude. He was basically hired to paint a portrait of her mother, and I have read accounts that indicate he was a little bit more interested in her sister right from the get-go, right when they met.
Now, I was not familiar with that because, like, I knew about, you know, the idea that he met Jean-Claude when he was doing the family portrait, and I've always thought, wow, that is really serendipitous, and, like, that's a good love story. But now you're throwing a wrench into that with the idea that he's more interested in the sister. I have no idea.
Well, that, and to admit that seems right. not a bright move, but yeah, I saw that somewhere in an interview, and you know, the love story between Christo and Jean-Claude, I have always found to be absolutely beautiful because they meet serendipitously as he's painting a portrait of her mother, and it sounds like it was kind of fairy tale love at first sight. I mean, she says, like I said, she studied Latin and philosophy. She was going to be a flight attendant and fly around the world, but she got into the arts because Christo was into the arts, and because, and you know, setting aside the problematic feminist lens perspective on all of that, just the idea that she loved him in such a way that she wanted to be working with him professionally as well as in that romantic relationship, and that he loved her and was so dedicated to her, he continued to bring the arts that they planned together into the world years after she passed away. I mean, they both seem to have been very devoted to each other.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that creativity that comes from collaboration, you know, they had that at a level that, you know, I can only imagine, just, you know, them playing back and forth with ideas, just listening to them talk about how they collaborate, how they work together. You know, it was just like a match made in heaven, both with the love story, but also with the creativity and all of the art that came from it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that idea, like you said, that they're bouncing ideas off of each other, they were working with other people as well and learning from other people. One of the things I've seen as influential in their development was 1958, Christo's going to the World's Fair in Brussels. He sees the American avant-garde art scene there. And 1961 is kind of when they got the first solo exhibition. This was a bunch of like dockside packages. We see him wrapping things in fabric at that time, but it's sort of smaller objects. And I guess, you know, because everybody in the art world seems to know each other, he's going to like Eve Klein's apartment and wrapping human beings. But then he realized like fashion designers have kind of covered that ground. So he's looking for other stuff. And that's where he and Jean-Claude got the idea of wrapping buildings.
Okay, before we dive into the wrapping public buildings, can we talk about Yves Klein for just a minute? Because he fascinates me.
I could talk about Klein for, you know, there's a lot.
You haven't done an episode on him, have you?
I'll have to have you back at some point.
Oh, man, I would love to. But yeah, just the things that I always talk to my students about with Yves Klein. He invented his own color, International Klein Blue, like invented it and named it after himself. It's a beautiful blue, by the way.
It is a gorgeous blue.
He is a judo master, like fourth or fifth degree black belt in judo. He literally wrote a book on judo.
He was convinced he could fly by the force of his own will.
Yes, he's got an entire photograph documenting it called Leap into the Void, which is also fascinating. And then he wrote the Monotone Symphony, which was 20 minutes of a single note followed by 20 minutes of silence. And that's his entire symphony. Like, the guy is just, he's fascinating with what he came up with.
And I still can't decide if I find him fascinating or insufferable. I think to read about is fascinating, but I think if I met him, I would have a hard time.
Yeah, if I can just admire International Klein Blue from a distance and never have to talk to him, I think that's the ideal situation.
Yeah, I mean, it is a gorgeous blue, though. In all fairness, absolutely gorgeous. And the world needs good blue pigments.
Absolutely. So, all right, let's go back to Christo and Jean-Claude.
Back to our main subject. So one of the things Christo and Jean-Claude are known for is the wrapping of the buildings. I mean, they do these monumental installations, or I guess they did, these monumental installations wrapping the Reichstag, wrapping islands, you know, the coast of an island wrapped in fabric. One of the largest pieces, or one of the latest pieces the two of them realized together, was the gates in New York.
Yes.
That was what, 2005, I want to say?
Yeah, 2005 in New York City. Yep.
And, you know, a lot of what they're doing is just transforming a space. And I always find it really interesting because they're playing with... It's public art that's sort of forced on the public. I mean, you wrap a building that people, whether they want to or not, have to interact with that. And it kind of, I mean, that's the intention behind it, I think, in a lot of ways. I find some problematic aspects to that, but we'll get into that stuff later. I think one of the last bits that I want to share in terms of like, context and everything to understand them and their development process, they took this stance that they did not want to be sort of beholden to outside interest groups or donors or anything like that. So they did not fund these giant art pieces through grants or anything else like that. They used their own money. What they would do is Christo would make drawings of what they planned to do. And then they would sell those drawings for millions of dollars. I wish I had the means to do that. But, you know, apparently people are willing to pay Christo for his doodles on top of a photograph.
And I mean, like, if I had the money, I absolutely would do that, because not only are you receiving an original artwork from Christo, but you're helping to fund like the project that's upcoming. So I really love the idea. But like you said, it's a brilliant way not only to make money, but also to be able to fight for your artistic vision. You don't even have to fight for it. You have this clear vision of what you want. Like you said, you're not beholden to anyone else. And being able to fund everything yourself really allows them to follow through on the vision that they have.
Yes, although they did often have a fight to do it. The process also would involve setting up a corporation for every one of these massive installations so that they would have a staff who were doing the environmental impact studies and all of that stuff that is not nearly as fun to look at or talk about, but I think is worth acknowledging because it is an important part of what they did.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long. you find it hard to sleep at night, then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds, like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night.
They're making art that's out into the world, and they did give thought to the impact on the world. So the materials were industrially recycled afterwards. They did do their due diligence. They did the research to make sure that they are not destructive. Because when I think about fabric floating around an island, I think of all of those poor sea creatures. But apparently they did too, and they had teams of professionals who were thinking about that, and I think it's important to be mindful of that. There is controversy around it, but I think they did the best they could to mitigate the risks involved with it.
Yeah, and like you said, they have teams. I'm thinking of the pink wrapped islands that from Miami, and I don't remember exactly what that's called. I apologize, but I know they wrapped like 11 different islands with this pink fabric, which is absolutely gorgeous. But, you know, they had a team of marine biologists making sure that there is not, an environmental impact. They had, those biologists and their crews also cleaning up the islands, like all of this trash, all of this debris. The engineers, the construction crews, part of their job was to clean up the environment. They're trying to leave things even better than they found them. And this was way back in 1983, I think, that was made. And so, 40 years ago, they were worried about the environment. And so I think that's something important to bring up, just sharing that they were conscious of all of these things for as long as they've been working.
Yeah, because it is an important piece of it. I mean, I don't think they're quite Andy Goldsworthy with the the way that they interact with the environment, but they're not Exxon either. They definitely were mindful in trying to do their best with what they could. And I think since we kind of were talking about the islands being wrapped, that probably is as good a segue as we're going to find to this piece we're looking at, specifically the floating piers. Now, this one was an installation in 2016, June 18th through July 23rd. Christo and his assistants used 100,000 square meters of this bright yellow, almost gold fabric to transform Lake Iseo in Italy. And basically what they did was they put this fabric on top of polystyrene cubes. So it became this floating bridge. It's like just at the surface of the water, so that people could have that sensation of walking on water. I mean, as you step, from what I understand, it would sink a little bit. The water would get on, like your feet would get wet. The fabric would get wet, and it would move with the undulating water. Estimates are somewhere between 72,000 and 100,000 people a day went to this. So like 1.2 million people over those 16 days got to walk on water and have this bridge connecting a small island to the mainland. So now I would like to give you the opportunity to share your thoughts, your reactions. What do you see in this piece? What's jumping out at you?
Well, I'm fascinated by the piece and by the experience, I guess, as well. Like we talked about the islands that were wrapped previously, but that was only a visual experience. And I think to be able to turn this into more of a tactile or more of a physical experience, I think is something that conceptually is really impressive. And, you know, I love the fact that they just kind of sat on this idea for like 45 years, because I think 1970 was when they first came up with this. And, you know, it wasn't realized until 2016, which I think is incredible that they spent that much time or were willing to come back to it after that long. But visually, like I said, it's striking because it stands out from the water. The bright yellow fabric, it creates this incredible contrast, not only with the water, but with the hills, with the mountains surrounding it. You know, it's somewhat a little bit drab, I guess, as a landscape. But then when you have this bright fabric standing out from it, it really emphasizes the line, really emphasizes the color. And you can really dive into thinking about those contrasts. But yet at the same time, somehow it looks like a natural part of the lake. Like it just seems like it's always been there, which I think is, again, absolutely fascinating visually. And so just being able to see all of that, how it contrasts but blends in at the same time, I think is like a work of magic. And like I said, being able to experience that both visually, like from the outside, I know this is surrounded by mountains and hills. And so just thinking about all the different angles, all the different views you would be able to see from this, you know, I would love to experience that. But then, as you described so perfectly, just the ability to walk on this, experience it physically, and just kind of see what it's all about. Like you're literally walking on water. You're walking in the middle of a lake. And I think that creates a very unique experience. And like you said earlier, the public really doesn't have a choice here. They, you know, this is forced on them. But I think looking at it, experiencing it is going to be a positive experience for almost anyone who is lucky enough to be a part of it there. So anyway, I'm not sure which of those things you want to respond to, because I talked a lot, but there's a lot of exciting stuff happening in this work.
There's a lot in there. And I think you covered so many of the things that I was thinking of too. You know, the contrast between the yellow and the water. I mean, we're talking near opposites. It's practically a complementary color scheme there. Mm-hmm. And that does create this visual shock as you see it right off the bat. Even before you've touched it, you get this sense that the landscape is transformed. And I think it's not just the color scheme, but as you said, it's surrounded by water and mountains and trees. It's this natural environment, but that gold element is clearly artificial. It is so hard-edged and geometric. I mean, the fabric around that tiny island, it's like a rectangle around it. It changes the silhouette from an organic shape to a geometric one. And the land bridge is straight lines as a pathway. And I think one of the things that I go back and forth on as I look at this, because the experience of it to me sounds so magical. And like, that's the most exciting part to me, is the way it makes the world a magical place for a little while. It's a little bit surreal. It feels like wish fulfillment to some extent. But I wonder, how different would the experience be if that fabric were camouflaged? I wonder about the sensation if I couldn't see the bridge, if I looked down and that fabric matched the water.
Right. And then you feel yourself sinking ever so slightly with each step you take. Like, yeah, that would be fascinating and disconcerting. I'm not sure what that experience would be like.
Yeah, I think some people would find it horrifying and others exhilarating. But yeah. That's the one thing that I kept thinking about, because the thing about Christo's work in my mind is Christo and Jean-Claude, I mean, this was the first really large piece that Christo completed after Jean-Claude had passed away. And I still would credit the two of them for this piece, because mm-hmm. as you had mentioned, you know, the two of them came up with it together back in the 70s, and he was just able to bring it to life later on. But I really wonder about, like, a big part of their work was all about creating this barrier and this intrusion into a space to make you rethink the role of the arts and society and all of these things coming together and how we interact with them. But I really wish with this one, it could have been camouflaged. That's like the one note I'd have for them. And I'm sure they would really care about my opinion on that.
Possibly. I gotta say that, like, I disagree. Like, I think, you know, from an experiential lens, like, I think it would be more fun to take that walk on camouflage. But visually, like, this works for me. This screams Christo and Jean-Claude to me. I feel like it fits in with everything else they've done. And, you know, I think the thing I maybe love most about it is that contrast that we talked about, that yellow laying so nicely on the surface of the water, but yet standing out so brilliantly. And so I think, although camouflage could be fun, I'm sticking with the yellow on this one.
That's fair enough. I would definitely agree. It does fit in with their style over, you know, the course of their body of work. I mean, that is a choice that clearly is in line with the way that they have done things. I guess I'm giving away all of my position here. I generally don't like the aesthetics. I don't like the look of their stuff. I find the concepts interesting. I find the experience of it interesting. But I'm not a fan of the look of a lot of it.
Is this why you would not be buying drawings from Christo?
It's one of the reasons. You know, I mean, that, and I don't think my bank would cover the check for me.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about this one?
No, I don't think so. Can I share a story really quickly, though?
Always.
Okay. So I live in Omaha, and I was lucky enough to see a talk that Christo and Jean-Claude gave in 2007, 2008, just a year or two before Jean-Claude passed away. They came to Contemporary Art Gallery that we have here in Omaha, and I was able to go see them. It was a brilliant talk. Loved going through all their work. And just thinking about, you know, Christo completing this posthumously, like after Jean-Claude had passed. And, you know, that was one of the things that they had talked about. You know, someone had asked them in the Q&A portion, you know, how long are you going to keep doing this? And they both said, oh, we're going to keep doing it forever. You know, even if one of us dies, one of us passes away, the other has plans to complete a lot of our work, to keep working on these things. And so, you know, even though they were separated by death, they're still in a lot of sense collaborating and, you know, putting these things together, which I think is a wonderful thing. And, you know, I'm hoping to see even more of their ideas come to life, if it's possible, which I'm not sure that it is at this point anymore, but just that fascinating concept of them continuing to work together after death, I think is a lovely story and makes for a good background to these pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do believe it is possible for more of their work to be realized, even though both have passed away. After Christo passed away, people wrapped the Arc de Triomphe in France in his honor. I think it was like a year after he had passed. But, you know, Christo, Jean-Claude, and Tupac still coming out with stuff long after they've passed away. And I'm wrapping it up.
I want
just a 3-point rating scale.
And
where should this hang? The Louvre?
Is this something to look at?
The lab. Is this something to learn from? Or the loop.
British for the bathroom.
Yeah,
there's the loop joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
Okay, so as soon as you hit me up with the Christo and Jean-Claude topic. I started thinking about this. And I really want to say the Louvre because it's it's great work and it's up in the upper echelon for me of contemporary art. But I'm going to say it belongs in the lab. And this goes back to our conversation about the work being forced on the public. And I think we can look at that as a learning opportunity. And because when these huge works are created, they cross over from the art world into popular culture, into the news. Like, it is a worldwide news article when the Arc de Triomphe gets wrapped. And so I think it gives an opportunity for people who don't know about art, who haven't experienced a lot of this art, to learn about Christo, about Jean-Claude, and about whatever may develop from there. And so I think given those opportunities, given the scale of attention that their pieces get, I think this is, like I said, a perfect chance for people to learn from them. So I'm going to say that this belongs in the lab.
Interesting. I always try to find a way to disagree with people, but that's really hard to disagree with. Since you have covered the Louvre and the lab, I'm going to make the case for the Lou.
This hurts. Before I even hear it, this hurts me, but go on.
And I don't mean that necessarily in the insulting of the artwork, you know, this is a waste, but I think this category can also be used to describe pieces that don't need to be around forever, for pieces that are ephemeral and that we're okay with letting go of. You know, I think this piece, like all of Christo's work, is great for a moment, but it would wear thin if it were to be a permanent installation. And so I think the fact that it will be disassembled, that it will come down, and that it will change the environment for a period, and then it's a memory and it's documented and we know it happened, but we don't see it and experience it constantly. I think that's a part of the work. And so for that reason, I'm going to throw it in the loo.
All right, that's fair. You make a very good argument for it, so I can accept that.
I was raised by a lawyer. I'm trained in making good arguments, whether I agree with them or not. But I do want to wrap this up by just saying once again, thank you so much. This is a surreal experience for me, getting to actually sit down and talk to an educator that I have looked up to and learned from for years. Thank you very much, Tim Bogatz, once again, from the Art of Ed University. And your podcast has certainly helped me, and I cannot imagine how many other art teachers have learned from you over the years. So thank you for all you do.
All right. Thank you, Kyle. I appreciate the kind words, of course, and I really enjoyed this conversation. So I very much appreciate the invite as well. And if we can ever do this again, I would love to come back.
Oh, you are always welcome. Thank you very much.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted. If you found this tolerable, please like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week in the show notes, on Twitter at WoodArtEd, and on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.